which is predicated on the rhythms of the body and especially the breath.
It's changed a bit since then.
Oh, okay, sorry. It's changed the title.
Yeah, my point.
So when you're ready to switch, it's just there. That little one's on there.
Sorry?
When you're ready to switch to the DVD, it's that one there.
Which one?
This little orange one, the two Americans. That's your top there, and that's the DVD.
So which one?
That's the DVD. Oh, brilliant. And you should just rip it, and it should just do its thing.
Is that?
Yeah.
I'll
be here as well.
So, what I want to ask in my paper is what literature can tell us about breathing, about the life of breath. What kinds of insights can writers add to our understanding of the ontology, perhaps, and the phenomenology of this most intimate, most automatic, and most vital of bodily actions? In this paper, I want briefly to consider the ways in which breathing and breath are figured in two writers who are not often discussed together. The English romantic poet John Keats, who died in Rome of tuberculosis in 1821, and the Anglo-Irish writer Samuel Beckett, who died in Paris from emphysema in 1989. And I want to talk about these two writers not just because both suffered from pulmonary conditions, but also because both, through their writing lives, attended in fascinating and illuminating ways to the question of breathing and of breath. In a letter to his publisher, John Taylor, from August 1820, the romantic poet John Keats wrote that his chest was in so nervous a state that anything extra, such as speaking to an unaccustomed person or writing a note, half suffocates me. Every line I write increases the tightness of the chest. Born in 1795, Keats was 24 years old and suffering from tuberculosis when he wrote the letter to Taylor, and would die from the disease 6 months later, in February 1821, aged just 25. The letter to Taylor makes clear that, for Keats, breathing was not something transparent and not to be taken for granted. Indeed, consumption, as tuberculosis was then known, was a condition which Keats had already lived with for much of his life. His mother died from it in 1810, and in the autumn of 1818, the disease took his brother, Tom, whom Keats had nursed to the end. Partly because of these early experiences and because of the need to support his family, Keats decided early in life to become a physician. He left school in 1811 to become an apprentice to the surgeon Thomas Hammond, and in 1815 registered as a student at St. Guy's Hospital in London. By 1816, he was licensed to practice as an apothecary and as a surgeon. Ever alert to the radical sense of contingency that had characterised his early life, a sense that was no doubt only enhanced by his medical education, Keats is generally considered to be by far the most embodied of all the English romantic poets. Some of his most famous poems, The Spring Odes of 1819, Isabella, The Eve of St. Agnes, the Hyperion poems, and indeed his last great poem, To Autumn, from September 1819, are all intimately responsive to the body and to bodily effects. And all are particularly alert to what we might call the fragility of the body, to its weakness, or weaknesses rather, to sickness, and to its ultimate irreducible mortality. Human sickness is particularly prominent in Ode to a Nightingale from May 1819, in which Keats contrasts the sublime and seemingly immortal beauty of the Nightingale's song with the human condition, writing in stanza three of the ode of here, where men sit and hear each other groan, where palsy shakes a few sad last grey hairs, where youth grows pale and spectre thin and dies, where but to think is to be full of sorrow and leaden-eyed despairs, where beauty cannot keep her lustrous eyes, or new love pineth them beyond tomorrow. The human condition is figured as either a grey-haired, trembling old man, or as a youth wasted by disease, growing pale, spectre-thin, and dying, undoubtedly a memory of the death of Keats's younger brother, Tom. In the next stanzas, it's characteristically the embodied dull brain that vexes and retards, rather than the mind or spirit or soul. Similarly, another of Keats's spring odes, the Ode to Psyche, celebrates the Greek goddess and of the soul, Psyche, but closes with a striking evocation not so much of the mythological figure of Psyche as with that other sense of Psyche, what Keats himself calls the working brain in the ode, an organ of which the medically trained poet would have had first-hand experience. As this might suggest, Keats's focus is more frequently on the nerves than on the abstract romantic notion of sensibility, and as Christopher Ricks, the only critic to have written books on both Keats and Beckett, has suggested, bodily distaste and unease is a prominent feature of his work, particularly, according to Ricks, in relation to the question of blushing from embarrassment, a somatic bodily inscription of inner emotion. And Keats's poetry often registers a vaguely uneasy relationship with the body, encapsulated, for example, in the word ooze. He refers to the ooze from living blood in Endymion and to an ooze-born goddess. In Isabella, Keats talks of an odorous ooze. In Hyperion, locks of hair ooze with sweat, and later there are locks not oozy, while autumn is encapsulated in the last oozings of the cider press into autumn. Keats, then, may be said to incorporate the somatic into the aesthetic, not least in relation to breathing and breath. One of the distinctive features of Keats's poetry and his letters, in fact, is the way in which breath and breathing are repeatedly associated with or employed to express a certain aesthetic condition. No one else does this to this degree, or at least no one else does it like John Keats. No one makes this link between the intimacy of the body and the intricacy of the aesthetic quite with the same intensity. In a letter from May 1818, for example, Keats attempts to express what it is he responds to most in the most famous poem of his favourite contemporary poet, William Wordsworth. In Tintern Abbey, he writes, Wordsworth is explorative of what he calls those dark passages. Among the effects this breathing is father of is that tremendous one of sharpening one's vision into the heart and nature of man, of convincing one's nerves that the world is full of misery and heartbreak, pain, sickness and oppression, Keats writes. Breathing here is synonymous with anima, a current of air, wind, breath, the vital principle, soul, life itself. What Keats admires about Wordsworth is a poet's aim to bring the aesthetic in touch with the real, with the dreary, soul-sapping, corporeal assaults and miseries, as well as its pleasures, wonders, and delights, an aspiration that Keats made his own. In Keats's writing, as in his life, breathing comes to embody not only the beautiful and the sublime, in other words, the aesthetic, but also the misery, heartbreak, pain, sickness, and oppression of life. In another letter from February 1818, Keats again aestheticizes breathing and breath, arguing that poetry's, and I quote, touches of beauty should never be halfway, and that poetry should make the reader breathless instead of content. Rather differently, in a marginal annotation to his copy of Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida, Keats comments, syntactically holding his breath, so to speak, that, and I quote, "one's very breath while leaning over these pages is held for blowing this line away." So here, breath is breathlessness, holding one's breath, becomes precisely an example of kind of an enhanced presence, the enhanced presence of this kind of aesthetic. The beauty of the line, its wonderful fragility. And if reading is a form of breathlessness, being read also involves what might be termed a disaspiration or indeed expiration. In another letter, Keats tells his friend, the painter Benjamin Robert Hayden, that the idea of Wordsworth reading one of his, Keats's poems, put me out of breath. Itself a synonym for the ambivalent taking away of one's breath. I'll return to that point later. Keats's own writing of breathing evokes the implicit duality in the act of respiration. As the ambiguous possessive in the phrase life of breath itself indicates, the intake of breath is not only life-sustaining, but in effect the very condition of life itself. The body, as we know, cannot survive without breathing for more than about 3 minutes, I think it is. Lack of oxygen in the heart ultimately triggers a heart attack, and the shortage of oxygen in the brain causes brain damage. But the outtake of breath, expiration, entails a release of toxins, of noxious matter, and can therefore be understood to embody decay and death itself, the ultimate expiration, as it were. In breathing is embodied, and perhaps rehearsed, life's vacillating rhythm and its oscillating drives, as Freud would argue in Beyond the Pleasure Principle in 1920, his most celebrated exposition of the life and death instincts. And it is this that can be found intensely at work in the poetry of Keats himself. In Ode to a Nightingale, the speaker celebrates the nightingale's unrestricted airflow as it sings in full-throated ease. In contrast to the nightingale's full-throated song, the speaker recollects that, "I have been half in love with easeful death, called him soft names in many a mused rhyme, to take into the air my quiet breath." There is a distinction here between the nightingale's easeful or unrestricted song on the one hand, and on the other, the easeful death which is summoned to take away the speaker's faint breath, vaporizing and dissolving into the air. And there's also something suggestively paradoxical about the vaporous breath being recorded in writing, eternalized in the breathlessness of its future readers. Breath and breathing is also prominent in what is perhaps Keats's most famous poem, Ode to a Grecian Urn, also from May 1819. In this poem, the speaker gazes longingly at the forever youthful figures depicted on the urn, who now cannot fade, witnessing their more happy love, more happy, happy love, forever warm and still to be enjoyed, forever panting and forever young, all breathing human passion far above. That slightly dissonant phrase, breathing human passion, suggests that to be human is to breathe, and to breathe is to have, to be capable of, human passion. But there's also that more visceral version of breathing in these lines, panting. The heights of aesthetic and carnal ecstasy here produce a breathless panting, an eternal panting that defies the faint, quiet, transient breath of the poet. The aesthetic, like carnal ecstasy, has its origins in the body, in the Greek aistikos, meaning aesthetic, sensitive, sentient, which in turn was derived from aistonomai, meaning I perceive, feel, sense. The origin of poetry itself lies with pneuma, with voice, with speaking. Originally merely an oral art, however, a variety of speech or vaporized language, as Jacques Derrida calls it, poetry forgets itself. Breath, and much less breathlessness, is not the stuff of history. It will not last, unlike the monumental bars or the cold and eternal Elgin marbles in the British Museum that inspired Keats to write the ode, or indeed Keats's own now monumental poem. Poetry in Keats's mind, as his own understanding of the breathlessness of reading testifies, can ensure a posthumous breathing, a way of preserving one's anima in the reading of others. In writing, as in breathing, is embodied the paradoxical desire to remain and to disappear. As Maurice Blanchot has argued, the writer must write in order to be able to die. It is this paradoxical desire to respire and to expire that is embodied in Freud's controversial statement that the aim of all life is death, in his implication that our life's work is our own death. It's present too in Keats's quiet breath that vaporizes, but is also recorded in the monument of his poetry, in the eternal panting and breathing of human passion. It's this very embodiedness, this viscerality of Keats's writing that appeals so much to the poets of the Great War, who saw in Keats's writing a model to embody their own physical suffering in the face of the horrors of war. But Keats's sensitivity to somatic experience also captured the imagination of the 20th century modernist, Samuel Beckett. For Beckett, as for Keats, breathing was no simple matter. Born in 1906, he suffered from frequent chest infections and was plagued by pleurisy in his 20s. In January 1938, he was near fatally stabbed. The knife missed the lung and the heart by a hair's breadth, but pierced the pleura, the thin membrane covering the lung. In 1968, he suffered a near fatal abscess on the lung, which put him into convalescence for more than a year. In his final years, Beckett suffered from severe emphysema, which ultimately put him into a coma and took his life in December 1989. Beckett read Keats in May 1930, at the age of 24, and wrote evocatively to his friend, the Irish poet and critic Thomas McGreevy, that I have been doing a little traipsing and reading Keats. I like that crouching, brooding quality in Keats, squatting on the moss, crushing a petal, licking his lips and rubbing his hands, counting the last oozings hours by hours. I like him the best of all because he doesn't beat his fist on the table. I like that awful sweetness and thick, soft, damp, green richness and weariness. Take into the air my quiet breath. Beckett's reading of Keats brilliantly registers the vacillation in the poetry, the awful sweetness and thick, soft, damp, green richness, but also the brooding quality, the last oozings, the weariness and the quiet breath. The unusually visceral oozings of Keats's poetry become something like a motif in Beckett's writing, in which everything oozes, as Estragon explains to Vladimir in Waiting for Godot. It's never the same pus from one second to the next, he explains, in a tone far, far starker than anything we could imagine in the poetry of Keats. As the quotation from Waiting for Godot suggests, the mood of Beckett's lush reading of Keats, too, changed rapidly. And only a few months after his first reference to Keats in this letter of May 1930, Beckett recorded in his book on Proust the terrible, panic-stricken stasis of Keats, crouched in a mossy thicket, annulled like a bee in sweetness, drowsed with the fume of poppies, and watching the last oozings hours by hours. Here, it's as if Beckett had reread Keats's Ode to Autumn, almost his last, and certainly the poet's last great poem, and seen in it not the hint, as Percy Bysshe Shelley put it at the end of his ode to the West Wind, that if winter has come, spring can't be far behind, with its conventional reference to the cycle of seasons and to rebirth, but an allusion instead to the finality of Keats's own impending death. A similarly morbid reference to Keats is found in Beckett's 1934 collection of short stories, More Pricks Than Kicks. The story, Dante and the Lobster, culminates in what else but the boiling of a live lobster. The narrator muses, "In the depths of the sea, in the depths of the sea it had crept into the cruel pot. For hours, in the midst of its enemies, it had breathed secretly. It had survived the Frenchwoman's cat and his witless clutch. Now it was going alive into scalding water. It had to take into the air my quiet breath." Despite appearances, there might, after all, be something Keatsian about this passage, beyond that despairing quotation from Ode to a Nightingale. There's also the cruelty of the situation, the secret quiet breath, and the premature death. As Stephen Connor has pointed out, even the boiling seems to have a reference to Keats's ode, with the stintless ebullition of the birdsong and the beaded bubbles winking at the brim that appear in the second stanza of Keats's poem. In All That Fall, Beckett's first radio play from 1956, the protagonist, Maddie Rooney, is embodied in the stage directions and on air by the sounds of her breath, sobbing, exploding, breathing hard, sounds of effort, and sound of handkerchief loudly applied, as the stage directions have it. Breath here has become thickened, materialised as almost matter, and it serves to identify for us the fact that Maddie Rooney is elderly and in bad health. As Connor argues, the bubbling, gurgling, aromatic atmosphere of Keats's ode becomes in the eroded atmosphere of breath in Beckett's work, becomes the eroded atmosphere of breath in Beckett's work, in which the air will be panted rather than poured out, though as we've seen, panting is also a Keatsian word. The pouring forth of the nightingale's voice becomes Malone's gurgles of outflow in the novel Malone Dies, and the sucking of the sea at the end of Embers, Beckett's second radio play from 1959, is conjoined with and interpreted by Henry's recall of the plumber's visit to deal with the waste or the drainpipe. In Beckett's late play, That Time, from 1975, we have an auditor on stage, old white face, long flaring white hair, as if seen from above outspread, with eyes shut in the image of someone on their deathbed. Auditors listening to memories of his own life, indeed reliving his life, and we hear in the stage directions his breath, audible, slow and regular, and it's really foregrounded in stage productions. Thickened as almost the soul stirring still, save for the opening of the eyes twice in the course of the play. It's a kind of minimal marker of life here, I suppose. But Beckett's most striking and strikingly stark work on breath is his 1969 play Breath, a 45-second play with no dialogue and a set that has faint light on stage littered with miscellaneous rubbish, which seems to stand for all the detritus of a life. What we hear is a faint cry, immediately inspiration, and so slow increase of light. These are stage directions. This is followed by expiration and slow decrease of light, and immediately cry as before. And that is all we are given, life and death. The play features a birth cry and a death cry or death rattle, and captures both the brevity of life and the blurred boundary, barely living, barely dead, between life and death in Beckett's work. And, well, I'll just say that while the avowedly secular Keats was interested in the materiality of embodied experience, his concern was ultimately with the aesthetic, with being breathed to life in the breathless reading of others. I think I shall be among the English poets after my death, he announces, aspiringly to his brother and sister-in-law in a letter of October 1818. The aesthetic, in other words, even in its materiality, offered Keats a means of transcendence. But in Beckett's work, by contrast, and as Breath testifies, but you haven't seen it, there is a stern, even stark refusal to aestheticise, to endow experience with a signification beyond itself, to make it other than itself. As Ham says to Clove in the 1957 play Endgame, we're not beginning to mean something. To which Clove replies, mean something? You and I mean something? Ha, that's a good one. When we breathe out, in a sense, I suppose what I'm suggesting here that in breathing is embodied very life, the very kind of concept of life itself, that when we inhale, we are taking in life-sustaining oxygen. When we exhale, it's waste product, it's toxins, and it's almost a kind of anticipation of the final expiration, I suppose. But for Keats, reading itself, you know, this idea of presence that you talked about in breathlessness, the aesthetic is itself a kind of experience where we inhale and hold our breaths in order to enhance the presence of the aesthetic, as it were, in order to kind of make it more present. And so in art, in a sense, and in Keats's understanding of breathing, is entailed this breathlessness itself. I suppose that's what I mean. Does that make sense? And then Keats writes and records his breath, because if poetry were just, and this is Derrida's point, but if poetry were just oral, as it were, as it used to be, a mere spoken form, it would just vanish, vaporise, disappear into air. So he inscribes this in order to, in a sense, live on in the breathless breathing of his future readers, as it were, so that he can be almost kind of prosthetically breathed into life again.
So the return is just like the vanishing subject, and then if you remove something, the presence becomes more prominent. It's a way of emphasizing this by removing something.
That's it. When he's removing, but by holding your breath, you hold your breath. And we do this in awe, in the face of the aesthetic. We see something awe-inspiring, something beautiful, and it makes us breathless. We hold our breath.
I just wanted to comment on that, because I've got this kind of idea, particularly with the Romantic poets, the notion of inspiration as meaning inspiration in terms of the way in which nature inspires you to write. To what extent can we connect that with the notion of inspiration and breath?
It was mentioned today, the idea of inhaling as being in itself a kind of, meaning.
Wasn't there within Wordsworth some notion of a particular idea of a wind as well? I'm trying to fight this out. And
there is that conflation, in a sense, of inspiration and and air in, in, you know, precisely that poem. Yeah, absolutely. But the two become one. Yeah.
Just to say as well, I think if the nightingale is a metaphor for the poet with full-throated ease, then I think he'd said the poet is the most unpoetical of creatures.
He did so say that, yeah.
Sense that the nightingale is more poetic than the poet, and it's taking in the air in full-throated ease without the constriction of the performance.
But I suppose the, you know, just the very fact that breathing, I mean, he writes about breathing and about oozing. Oozing appears something like 10 times at least in his poetry. It's a striking word. It only appears once in Shelley's poetry. It's in Ode to the West Wind, and only twice in Wordsworth's poetry. So it's far more prominent in Keats, and it's a kind of visceral metaphor, I suppose, in many ways. And I suppose the very thought that both of these writers knew that breathing is not something that one can take for granted, that they, breathing was simply not transparent, makes them ever alert to the idea of breathing, and I suppose it's one reason why it appears so prominently in their writing.
Okay.